3. 6 days after depositing the Cubans in San Juan, the Oregon had rounded the Cape of Good Hope. Inside the control room, the seas beyond the bow were projected on a high-definition 4x8-foot screen. There was little to see. The sun was dipping in the west, and the Oregon was in an empty part of the Indian Ocean where few cargo ships steamed. 20 minutes ago, Holly Kasim had caught the glimpse of a blue whale. Triggering the underwater sensors, Kasim made a record of the mass of the beast, then began to scan his data banks for a match. "She's a new one," Kasim said. Franklin Lincoln, the huge, pitch-black man who was sharing duties in the control room, stared up from his game of computer solitaire.
"You need to find a different hobby."
"It passes the time," Kasim noted.
"So does this," Lincoln said, "and it barely uses any computer power."
A buzzer sounded, then the ship slowed and went dead in the water. From the north, a black amphibious plane approached, made a pass over the Oregon to check the direction of the wind by the flag on the flagstaff, then gracefully dropped into the water and taxied alongside. "The chairman has arrived," Kasim noted. Once safely aboard the Oregon, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo made his way to his stateroom. Walking inside, he shut the door, tossed the bag containing his gray wig and fake beard on the bed, then kicked off his shoes and started unbuttoning his shirt as he made his way to the head. Unlike most ships, where the bathroom facilities are almost an afterthought, his was large and opulent. A sunken copper tub with jets sat against the side of the hull, with a brass-lined rectangular porthole giving a view of the water outside. Angled next to the tub was a separate shower, decorated with Mexican tile. Along the bulkhead toward the bow was a cabinet containing a copper sink, with drawers beneath. The floor was dark hardwood with thick cotton throw rugs. A recessed toilet was set back in the bulkhead across from the sink, and a Philippine carved mahogany sitting bench graced one wall. Cabrillo stared at his image in the mirror above the sink. His blonde, crew-cut hair was in need of a trim, and he made a mental note to schedule an appointment with the ship's barber, who also doubled as a masseuse. His skin had a light pallor, the result of stress, he knew, and his eyes showed red from the strain. He was tired, and his joints felt stiff. Sitting on the mahogany bench, he slid off his trousers and stared down at his prosthetic leg. The leg was the third he had owned since he had lost it in a naval battle with the Chinese destroyer Chengdu, when the corporation had been covering a Numa operation in Hong Kong. But it was a good one. It worked almost as well as the one he had lost. Rising, he walked over and began to draw a bath in the copper tub. While the bath filled, he shaved at the sink and brushed his teeth, then removed the prosthetic limb and climbed into the water. As he soaked, his thoughts drifted back. Cabrillo came from a family that had descended from the first explorer to discover California, but despite his Spanish surname, he looked more like a Malibu surf rat than a conquistador. He'd been raised in Orange County by an upper-middle-class family. California in the 1970s had seen wild times, filled with sex and drugs, but Cabrillo had never drifted that way. By his nature, he'd been both conservative and patriotic, almost a throwback. When everyone he knew was growing long hair, he'd kept his short and well-groomed. When clothing tastes had run toward torn denim and T-shirts, his wardrobe had remained neat and presentable. But this had not been his own form of protest against the time. It was just who he was. And even today, he was still a bit of a clothes horse. In college, he'd majored in political science and had been an active member of his university's ROTC program. So it was not a surprise when the CIA had offered him a job at graduation. Juan Cabrillo was just what they were seeking in new agents. He was bright without being bookish, stable without being boring, and flexible without being outlandish. Trained in Spanish, Russian, and Arabic, he'd proved a master at disguise and stealth. Inserted into a country, he could read the pulse of the people instinctively. Fearless but controlled, within a few short years, he'd become a valuable asset. Then came Nicaragua. Teamed with another agent, he and his partner had been ordered to stem the growth of the pro-communist Sandinistas, and at first Cabrillo had made inroads. But within a year, the situation had spun out of control. It was the oldest story in the world, too many chiefs and not enough Indians. Chiefs in Washington calling the shots, native Indians in Nicaragua paying the price. And when bombs had burst, the fallout had blown back in their faces. Cabrillo had been one of the fall guys, and he'd taken the hit for his partner. Now the partner, high up the ladder at the CIA, was repaying the favor. The man had been funneling jobs to the corporation almost since their inception, but he'd yet to offer one with a potential payday this large. And all Cabrillo and his team needed to do was to accomplish the impossible. While Cabrillo finished his bath and got dressed, Kasim and Lincoln continued their watch. By the time they were relieved, at midnight, Kasim would log one more whale. Lincoln would have played 32 games of Klondike, and both men would have read three of the magazines that had been loaded aboard in San Juan. Lincoln tended to aviation periodicals. Kasim, automobile digests. Quite frankly, there was little work for the two men. The Oregon ran herself. 30 minutes later, clean and dressed in tan slacks, a starched white shirt, and a Bill Blast blazer, Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo was sitting at the large mahogany conference table in the corporate meeting room. Linda Ross was across the table, sipping a Diet Coke. Eddie Seng sat next to Ross, flipping through a stack of papers. Mark Murphy was farther down the table, stroking a throwing knife against a leather strap. Murphy found the action relaxing, and he tested the edge against a piece of paper. "How'd the auction go?" Max Hanley asked. "The target brought $200 million," Cabrillo said easily. "Wow," Ross said. "That's a hefty price." At the end of the table, in front of a bank of floor-to-ceiling monitors that were currently blank, Michael Halpert turned on a laser pointer, then pressed the remote for the monitors. He waited for Cabrillo, who nodded for him to start. "The job came from Washington to our lawyer in Vaduz Lichtenstein, a standard performance contract, half now, half on delivery. $5 million of the $10 million fee has already been received. It was washed through our bank in Vanuatu, then transferred to South Africa and used to purchase gold bullion, as we all agreed." "It seems," Murphy said, shaving off a sliver of paper with a knife, "that after all those machinations, we should just steal the Golden Buddha for ourselves. It would save us a hell of a lot of time and effort. Either way, we end up with the gold." "Where's your corporate pride?" Cabrillo said, smiling, knowing Murphy was joking, but making the point anyway. "We have our reputation to consider. The first time we screw a client, the word would get out. Then what? I haven't seen any want ads for mercenary sailors lately." "You haven't been looking in the right newspapers," Seng said, grinning. "Try the Manila Times or the Bulgarian Bugle." "That's the problem with stealing objects out of history books," Ross noted. "They're tough to resell." "I know a guy in Greece," Murphy said, "who would buy the Mona Lisa." Cabrillo waved his hands. "All right, back to business." A map of the world filled the main monitor, and Halpert pointed to their destination. "As a crow flies, it's over 10,000 miles from Puerto Rico to this location," he noted. "By sea, it's a lot farther." "We're going to run up the costs just getting there," Cabrillo said. "Do we have any other jobs lined up in that part of the world after we finish with this?" "Nothing yet," Halpert admitted. "But I'm working on it. I did, however, require the lawyer to include a bonus if we deliver the object by a certain date." "How much and when?" Cabrillo asked. "The bonus is another million," Halpert said. "The date is March 31st. "Why March 31st? Cabrillo asked. "Because that's when they plan to have the leader return to his people." "Ah, good. All right. So we have a total of 7 days, 3 of which will be spent traveling. That gives us 4 days to break into a secure building, steal a gold artifact that weighs 600 pounds, then transport it nearly 2,500 miles to a mountain country that most people have only heard about in school." Halpert nodded. "Sounds like fun," Cabrillo said.